helpful to you as it was to me, in the sense that it clarified some myth and some practices that we do on a regular basis in our management of COPD exacerbation. So I'm going to start by talking for a couple of seconds about the burden of disease. Then I'm going to discuss the definition according to the GOLD initiative. And GOLD is what we primarily use. The GOLD guidelines are what we primarily use because they seem to adapt to the changing nature of COPD in terms of our knowledge of it and the management of this condition. I will touch on the impact on disease progression, talk about the risk factors, and then I will spend some time to discuss the pharmacological therapy. The non-pharmacological I will leave to the following speakers right after we get over this part. So, as you know, COPD is a major cause of death that has increased significantly in recent years. As a matter of fact, it's probably one of the very few conditions where incidence and mortality are increasing. Now, there are many reasons for that. We're not going to go over those, but make a long story short, this is a condition that is not going to go anywhere anytime soon. So more and more impact in our daily practice as pulmonary physicians. How about our area? Well, there is at least 13 million people that have COPD in the Middle East area, and this is literally the tip of the iceberg because I think the big majority are undiagnosed to date. Regardless of the disease state, regardless of the severity, all patients with COPD are symptomatic. Now, the degree of severity can influence the level of symptomatology that they may have, but by and large, they're all symptomatic. And this is why the GOLD initiative came up with a set of guidelines. And those guidelines, of course, they change. But the nice thing about them is that they're updated every year. So you can go online and you can download, like I did, the most recent. And you can look at all the different aspects of COPD aspects and features in terms of the definition, how it has changed, diagnosis and assessment, the therapeutic options, how to manage stable COPD, and there is a section that discusses the management of exacerbations. Of course, managing comorbidities is important, especially with the proposed ABCD paradigm that we've been dealing with for the past few years. Of course, ACOS is the newcomer. We're very excited to have it. It seems to pop everywhere. But ACOS is still a work in progress, I think, and I think this is going to change as the guidelines evolve. Why is this important, managing exacerbations? Well, because it turns out that the objectives of managing COPD hovers around two major areas, reduction of symptoms and the reduction of risk. How do we reduce symptoms? Well, what people get medications for, what they want, which is relieve their symptoms, less dyspnea, improve their exercise tolerance so they can do better, more, improve their health status so they're less sick, less likely to use the healthcare resources, and of course reduce risk by preventing disease progression as best we can. We're still limited in that capacity. Prevent and treat exacerbations. As I repeat any time I discuss this condition is that we have evidence that, strong evidence that we can reduce exacerbations. We have strong evidence that reducing exacerbations leads to a reduction in mortality. We still lack this immediate link of reducing mortality. So this is still an elusive objective. I think it's only a question of time, and once we probably phenotype our patients better. Again, phenotyping is something a la mode these days. What is an acute exacerbation? Well, GOLD did define it, and I highlighted the words that I thought were important. It's a sustained worsening of the patient's condition from a stable state, so stable state, patient reports worsening, and that is beyond day-to-day variation that is acute in onset and necessitates a change in management. Now, of course, you probably have the same problem that I have, which is, well, this is too broad, too loose. You can probably put an exacerbation where there may not be really one, and vice versa, especially that our patients seem to report probably half of the exacerbations that they encounter. So we have a big problem in that respect. This is also something that is a work in progress, but at least we have come up with something that can pinpoint towards a possible problem, because this, like I said, is linked to bad outcome and mortality. What do exacerbations do? Well, in addition to increasing mortality, they have a negative impact on the quality of life, on the symptoms and the lung function, increased economic cost on the whole system, essentially, and they of course, are related to an accelerated lung function decline. And in particular importance, I will touch on that a bit later, but in particular importance, what I personally believe to be the worst part of the GOLD paradigm, the group B patients. These patients have good lung function, but they are quite symptomatic, and they seem to lose more. They seem to lose more than all the others, even the D patients that are considered the most severe. So I think that we have an obligation to try to target those patients, the B patients, because they have the most to lose. And if we intervene early on, then maybe we can preserve their lung function that is at baseline in a good state and a normal range, essentially, or at least mild to moderate range. Of course, knowing that the prognosis is worse in frequent exacerbators is not new. This is stemming from the early 2000s, and this is only one example from thorax from 2005 that does pinpoint clearly and separates clearly the worse patients, those that are frequent exacerbators, namely that have two or more exacerbations. So these patients, actually, when they exacerbate more frequently, they will end up with a worse outcome. And, of course, why this is important, because this is going to reflect on everything that we mark and check and follow in COPD patients. So they will have a poorer health-related quality of life, increased inflammation. This is going to foster decline in lung function. They have higher myocardial infarction rate. I'm sure you know that the number one killer in COPD still is cardiovascular, more so than actually lung. So we have an important task to try to address also the comorbidities. But to make a long story short, whenever you have a frequent exacerbator, you're dealing with a prognosis that is worse. So how are COPD exacerbations best managed? Prevention, always. If you can prevent an exacerbation, this is key, because then we are going to immediately impact all the different parameters and, more importantly, the mortality. Treatment, okay, we had one. How do we go by treating it? Whatever we're doing, is it correct? How supported is it? Is it something that we should consider changing or altering at least? And finally, the use of a patient action plan. I, for one, probably do not do a good job in taking care of that. I probably say it to my patients, but I don't give them a patient action plan. I don't give them a printed or a soft piece of information that says, okay, watch for this, do this, call me if that. I tell them those things, and the hallmark of our patients is that they seem to forget. Once they are better, they seem to forget everything we tell them, especially with respiratory diseases. So how do we prevent COPD exacerbations? Well, by whatever we do on a daily basis. Smoking cessation. We say that all the time. I hope I'm making some impact in that respect, but I have to say that probably we are failing miserably in our ability to reduce the smoking, even in patients that are quite symptomatic and that seem to be lectured frequently and repeatedly on this condition. Vaccination, influenza vaccination, pneumococcal vaccination, these are important. There is evidence to support that they will actually reduce and prevent the incidence of exacerbations. Pulmonary rehabilitation, for the first year, pulmonary rehab is actually equivalent to pharmacological therapy, and we do have a big lacuna in that respect, and that's probably related to the logistics that we can have, not the knowledge. Self-management education, yes, it's important. Again, requires education, requires time, requires that we spend enough, whether we personally or our system, maybe a nurse or a helper or a resident or a fellow or something, people that are able to transmit the message that you as a physician want to transmit but may not have the time to do it with your busy schedules. Of course, treating with medications is also going to help in the prevention of exacerbations or in the delay of exacerbations, and this is something that I will touch upon as well. COMS Eclipse, 2010. This is a study that was a pivotal study in our understanding on how to approach COPD patients. It brought back the whole gamut of phenotyping. As you know, phenotyping is not new. We grew up on phenotyping, the pink puffer and the blue bloater. These are phenotypes. We used to do that whenever we talked about the more emphysematous type, that's your pink puffer, or the chronic bronchitic type, that's your blue bloater. So these were phenotypes. We then crossed and said, what was that? We were just describing looks and everything. And now we're going back to phenotyping because it turns out that not all COPDers are created equally. And this may be the major reason why most of the studies are coming out negative. So Eclipse essentially tried to look at the frequent exacerbator phenotype and try to come up with a certain guideline, if you will, to what to do with those patients. And what it did was the following. It actually followed those patients. It was over 2,000 patients, 2,138 to be exact. And again, they want to look at what made those patients frequent exacerbators. They look at different risk factors, and they found that the most important and reliable predictor of future exacerbations is, in fact, the history of exacerbations. Kind of sounds commonsensical, but it was not so obvious before the study. So this is what happens. So essentially, you have patients. Those patients are going to be either patients who had an exacerbation in the past year, one that led to a hospitalization, or more than one, so two, those that had zero to one, and those that had none in the past 12 months. And they followed them. And they followed them, and they found that over the period of follow-up, those that were exacerbators remained exacerbators. Those that were not exacerbators remain non-exacerbators. Those in the middle, we're not sure exactly what to do with them, and they're going to be the function of lots of post-hoc analyses and new hypotheses that will be tested in the future. But to make a long story short, now we can say, okay, I can target a population that can benefit from closer follow-up, from more aggressive treatment, and from disease modification. And this is something that actually was seen across different stages, but exacerbations increase in incidence and in their severity as the severity of COPD worsens. So a mild COPDer that has exacerbations will have exacerbations less than the moderate, less than the severe. So it is incumbent upon us to identify those exacerbators and address them very quickly and fully. What are other risk factors that came out from Eclipse? Well, reflux is one. There was a significant signal with that. Pulmonary hypertension, another one, and the pulmonary artery over the aorta ratio, when it was more than one, this was associated with a worse outcome as well for exacerbations. Now, the majority, of course, of exacerbations are caused by infections. So you're talking about viruses and bacteria. That's about 70 to 80%, depending on which reference you you quote. But In the big bulk is actually infectious. But there are other things, non-infectious. And the infections, well, you have your bacterial and viral. Viral are about 40 to 50%, and same with bacterial. And atypical are not a big signal. But you have non-infectious etiologies. In Eclipse, I think it was in Eclipse, they found that patients had also pulmonary emboli as one of the reasons why they had their exacerbations. So it's something that we need to keep in mind, especially when the level of hypoxia is out of proportion to the findings or when the patients require more resuscitation than with a regular exacerbation. What are the clinical manifestations? We know them. Dyspnea and increased cough, increased phlegm production, and increased purulence from the baseline. And, of course, some features may reflect severity. These are things that we use to triage patients and we'll see whether we need to keep them in the hospital or send them out. So use of accessory muscles, the ability to phonate, to talk, essentially how fidgety they are, the altered mental status. All those are features of severity that we can pinpoint when we're examining those patients in the emergency department. Like I said, you have to watch for alternate diagnoses because they can mimic them. So these patients have emphysema, they have bullous disease, they are prone to developing spontaneous pneumothoraces, secondary spontaneous pneumothoraces, and it's important for us to pinpoint those and not mistake them for an exacerbation. Like I said, PE is another one that needs to be put in perspective, especially when the overall picture does not fit what we believe it is at first sight. I would have to document, of course, the history of prior exacerbations because, as I said, this turned out from ECLIPSE and until further notice to be a very important predictor of future risk. What is the objective then? Confirm that we have an exacerbation, identify the etiology whenever this is possible, assess the severity, and determine whether there are contributing comorbidities, especially cardiac. So the initial evaluation is guided by the severity of the exacerbation because that is going to tell me what I'm going to test my patient for. What do I test them with? Usual stuff, what we do in the ER for most patients coming with dyspnea. So a chest x-ray, arterial blood gases, a CBC, maybe a CRP, a sputum culture plus or minus, pulse oximetry, etc., and other things that may need to be rolled out like an EKG and so on and so forth. But basic, essentially, nothing really out of the ordinary. Discharge or triage or admit, we triage, and it turns out about over 80% of exacerbations are safely managed at home or outside the hospital, essentially, after initial treatment in the emergency department. That's 4 out of 5 patients, and this is important. So if patients are evaluated, managed initially in the emergency department, given an action plan, and followed up, they will do well most of the time. This is from GOLD 2016, actually, and it talks about managing exacerbations, indications for hospital admission, and what I talked about, features of severity that would make you more likely to keep those patients for closer monitoring. Okay, we send them home. What do we give them? Bronchodilator. They are the mainstay of treatment. So metered dose inhaler or a home nebulizer device. They're both fine. Systemic corticosteroids. How much do you give them? What is a dose that may be effective for those patients when they go home? 0.5 mg/kg, 1 mg/kg? Well, it depends, actually. I don't know if I ever really thought about exactly how much to give them. I probably put it in that range, but the literature suggests that around 40 milligrams of prednisone or prednisone equivalent is enough for most of those patients that are discharged home. So we have evidence that this amount is probably going to take care of what is the objective from our intervention if those patients are going to be sent home. And there is literature for that. And this steroid treatment does have an impact. And the impact is actually small. It's not a big impact. Now, with what we're seeing with all the data coming out with bronchodilators that say that the backbone of COPD treatment is effective bronchodilation, now we know why you don't need that much steroids. So about 0.5 mg per kilo is usually sufficient, so about 40 milligrams prednisone, and for 5 days, that's probably all we need. We probably overshoot lots of times. Inhaled corticosteroids are not a suitable choice for not a substitute for systemic steroids. So I can keep them under inhalers, but the ICS is not going to be a good substitute for the systemic corticosteroids. They need a systemic intervention, and like I said, not that much and for a short period of time. How about antibiotics? Like I said, about maybe 70% are due to an infection, and about half of those are due to viruses. So antibiotics are not mandatory in those situations. We do give probably more than we should antibiotics because we're concerned. They're going home. I'm not sure what's going to happen. Maybe I'm mistaken. Maybe it is bacterial. So let's be on the safe side and give them an antibiotic. We do that quite frequently. Not really necessary lots of times. So if I need to choose one, I have to cover the usual suspects. Your three major organisms, strep, pneumo, MCAT, and H-flu. How about in-hospital management? Well, major components include what? Reversing airflow limitation. Again, bronchodilation. It has to be quite effective. Inhaled short-acting bronchodilators and systemic glucocorticoids. Treat infections. Usually in hospital, they require antibiotic because you cannot. It's more difficult for you to rule out a bacterial involvement initially in a patient that required inpatient management. ensuring adequate oxygenation, another area that I will touch on in a few seconds because we are anxious about that as well. And of course, our objective is to avert intubation and mechanical ventilation. So oxygen therapy is important. We need to treat to keep those patients in a saturation range of 88 to 92%. So if I'm concerned about CO2, shall I keep it around 85? Is that okay? No, actually, it's not okay. We need to make sure that they get enough oxygenation. So I have to aim for 88 to 92 because that's going to ensure proper demand and proper supply to the demand of the different major organ systems. Venturi masks can help because they can help me fine-tune the amount of oxygen that I need. So I need to use them, and I should not, because of fear of hypercapnia, shortchange them in terms of oxygen therapy. How about bronchodilators? Yes, they're very good. They're important. Short-acting beta agonist, backbone, give them. Nebulized MDI, if they can use an MDI effectively in the ER, so be it. If they cannot, then you can use a nebulizer. And the nebulizer is going to be effective in delivering the amount of medication to the target area. How many do I give? Continuous nebulization? No, there is no evidence that it makes a difference. Another thing that we probably don't do quite well in our ERs. If I increase the dose, does not confer additional benefits, only side effects. So I should not increase the dose of short-acting beta agonists that I provide, and I should try to shy away from continuous nebulized medications. They don't confer additional benefits. How about short-acting muscarinic antagonists? Well, evidence is patchy. There is no solid evidence that they do help, but we do use them, and there is little harm in using them, and they do add some additional bronchodilation. Paradoxically, sometimes they can cause bronchospasm themselves, so need to be a bit careful with that. Okay, well, steroids. How much steroids do I give for an inpatient, systemic steroids? It's interesting because if you look at the literature, actually, you'll be, well, I was a bit surprised, a bit shocked, I guess. The range is tremendous. You go from about 40 milligrams equivalent of prednisone per day to 125 milligrams Q6 hours of solumedrol per day. Actually, in the VA study, I will just mention a few words about it in a bit. It was a study that looked at patients with exacerbations, and they were treated for 2 weeks or 8 weeks, and the dosages were ranging from, like I said, about 40 milligrams to about 600 milligrams, and they looked at whether the outcomes were different, and lo and behold, there was no benefit conferred from the higher dose of steroids. So, like I said, the range is tremendous, from 40 to 600, depending on the severity of the exacerbation. And the outcome with the low dose was not worse than the high-dose patients. This is not one study. So this is one that came out from 2010 in JAMA. This was an observational study. It was a cohort, a large cohort that looked at hundreds of thousands of patients. Of course, they were selected, and they end up with about 70-some thousand. To make long story short, they found that the range of steroids were still quite wide, and they found that they were not based on the guidelines as they were stated at the time. This is 2010. Only less than 1% of the patients in those hospitals actually started with a low-dose steroids or with oral steroids. The majority gave high-dose intravenous steroids. And this was in a bit of a shocker because there were previous studies. This is the SCOPE study that came out previously in 1999 in the New England Journal of Medicine, and that did what I told you, that showed that if you give prolonged tapers or high dosages of steroids intravenously, you do not essentially address the exacerbation requirements for control quicker or more effectively than we do with a low dose, at a higher cost of side effects, of course, mostly with hyperglycemia. Well, the reduced study, I will discuss that in a bit more detail, was interesting because this is actually also from JAMA, and it came out a couple of years ago. And what it did was it compared. It said, okay, fine, let's do this. Let's try to compare a 5-day versus a 14-day treatment option for our exacerbations. And let's see what happens. About 700 patients, they were followed up, about 300 in each arm. And what happened was this. There was no difference. There was no difference in the outcomes between the two arms. So the five-day regimen was equivalent to the 14-day regimen. Now, on a good note, the 14-day regimen was not associated with increased risk of side effects, like, for example, the hyperglycemia and so on and so forth. But the five-day regimen was not inferior, and it was actually, in certain areas, probably a bit favorable in the sense that those patients could be managed quickly and discharged quicker home. The change in FEV1, they checked those patients repeatedly, an admission what they could, and followed up, and they found that the FEV1 recovery was similar also in the two groups, the 5 days versus the 14 days. Antibiotic use, like I said, it is recommended in hospital setting. You cover the usual suspects unless your patient is severe enough and has a certain history of or risk factors for other etiologic organisms that you need to address, and then you tailor your antibiotic coverage accordingly. Smoking cessation, paramount importance. Nutritional support, yes, there is some benefit to nutritional support. This is an old study from the Blue Journal, and it says that it has a role in the improvement of pulmonary function during an exacerbation because it's a hypermetabolic state. Unproven effectiveness, chest physiotherapy, we're not doing that much anymore. Mucolytic agents, love them, no damage supposedly, but very few evidence, and only in select individuals and in severe COPD patients where they may have a role. But by and large, there is little evidence to support their scheduled use. Methylxanthines, they have a role. It's a small role. They can help with the muscles as well, but they have a narrow therapeutic window, and that's why we're not crazy about them. Nebulized magnesium, not beneficial, so I wouldn't really worry much about them. Only a word about patient action plan. This is an example of an action plan where you can tell your patient about things to watch for and when to call, because that would make a difference in the partnership you can have with your patients. So essentially, management of COPD exacerbation, you have a customized action plan. You essentially look at your patient, and you adjust the bronchodilators that are the backbone of treatment. You add systemic steroids, antibiotics if there is a change in the purulence and the amount of sputum, and you try to prevent and treat respiratory failure. Oxygen, maintain a SAT of 88 to 92%. Even at the risk of hypercapnia, you have other things to do. Dr. Yeshi will discuss with you the non-invasive, which is a lifesaver essentially, and you follow up visit 48 to 72 hours after that. This is also mentioned, like I said, in the gold document, and there is a big section on the non-invasive ventilation that will be now discussed in detail. With that, I close, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Jvelikian, for respecting our time frame, and we're now open for any question.
Morning. Is there any place to give betamethasone depot IM for treating patient as an outpatient exacerbation?
Yes, you can. You can give them steroids whichever way you want. It's the dose, essentially, the effective dose that you're delivering. So what has been shown is that you do not need a lot of steroids. Now, those depot injections, they may actually reflect a much bigger amount of steroids. But if you're going to give the equivalent of about 40 milligrams for 5 days, then you have to kind of weigh it in that respect. But if it's easier for your patient and you give it, you probably can do that. Although I haven't seen any reference that specifically discussed IM injections in terms of steroids for managing exacerbations. Interestingly, patients, when they have an exacerbation, they are compliant. Because they're sick, when they have an exacerbation, they seem to listen. That's probably the only time they listen. Because they're sick, they can't breathe. It's afterwards what they do later on when they are feeling better and they go back to smoking, for example, and they find that there is no need to buy that expensive, probably not needed any longer inhaler you gave them. So the problem is not when they're having exacerbation. At that time, they are your perfect patient. President.
Thank you, George, for this excellent presentation. What about nebulizers of steroids?
Yes, there are nebulized steroid studies, mostly in asthma, and they are quite effective. And we do use them in that respect. They do seem to confer benefits similar to about 80 milligrams of prednisolone in the studies that were followed. And they are recommended in the asthma management in the ER as one of the steps that you can use. They are not mentioned as a mainstay of therapy, probably because there is this consensus. Maybe it's something that needs to be done, but probably because there is a consensus that inhaled or inhaled steroids do not seem to, at this time at least, replace the need for systemic steroids in those patients.
But we all use them.
Yes, we do, but we don't use them alone. Yeah, I do as well. I do them in the ER because I am convinced that they have a role, and to try to convince myself that that's how I can reduce my IV dose. But I think we overuse. Yes, I think we all overuse our steroids in those individuals. I think this is good if we can actually cut down. It's interesting because they found that patients who were on the equivalent of about 80 milligrams were in effect, over the whole hospitalization, similar in outcome to those that got 2.6 grams of prednisone equivalent in the VA study from the New England. So it's amazing what we throw at patients in terms of steroids. Some of them we need to. بضللي صوفر ما بيحل بس إنه بيطلع our anxiety كمان بس إنه I think we overdo it with steroids, most of us.
Thank you, George, for this presentation. Is there any clear recommendation what to do about the baseline treatment of the patients? I mean, patients who is receiving LABA or LAMA, and he is presented for an exacerbation. What do you do normally?
They don't give recommendations, but most of the time these are put on hold while they're receiving their inpatient treatment because they usually are going to end up with, instead of their inhaled steroids, they end up on the systemic steroid regimen, and they get their frequent nebulizer medications with the short-acting formulations. They don't give you any guidelines on, yes, continue the baseline or stable medications while they undergo their management for exacerbation. This is another thing that I always deal with. I honestly keep them. I mean, if somebody is on their combination ICS-LABA, why should I stop it while they're in-house? I can give them that additional push that they need. I convince myself again that this is going to reduce my need for systemic medications and also for the short-acting load that can increase the risk of arrhythmias and tremors. But there is no guideline that states that you should continue them or stop them. Thank you very much.